What is up? It is me, George G. We've got another awesome episode of the Aligned Money Show coming your way featuring Mr. Gary Cinderbrand. Gary has trained tens of thousands of financial advisors. He himself was a very, very, very successful financial advisor. Now he is focused on helping advisors transition their practices. We had an awesome conversation that, of course, started with two truths and a lie. And I got to tell you that Gary is awesome at that game. And then we talked about the reality of how many advisors are going to be retiring over the next 10 years. It is a lot. And how do you find successors to come in and make sure that your clients are taken care of in the way that you have been taking care of them all of these years? So making that transition and making it, in fact, a successful transition. And believe it or not, it is not as easy as one might think. I know you're going to love today's episode. Let's go. Gary, to get us started, give me two truths and a lie, please, sir.
That was a great question. So let's see what we can do. During my period of time with Merrill Lynch, I was traveling quite a bit. And it became problematic to get back and forth from cities that were relatively close to where I lived. Boston would be a good example on a Friday afternoon. My flight would be delayed. I'd get home Saturday morning. Earlier in my career, much earlier, I decided I wanted to learn to fly. So I took that back up. I guess it was some years ago, maybe, I don't know, going back 30 years, maybe. And I was working in Washington, D.C. at the time, doing some work down there for Merrill Lynch, and I was commuting back and forth. And this was shortly after 9/11, and things were a bit tense down there. So on takeoff one day, I couldn't get in contact with air traffic control, and I ended up probably being a little bit late, but they were late in responding. And unbeknownst to me, I flew directly over Andrews Air Force Base, where I wasn't supposed to be. I got a call from the tower at Andrews Air Force Base inquiring as to what I was up to. And when I looked to my right, there was an F-18 Hornet with their wheels down, fully loaded with weapons, and trying to maintain a relatively slow speed for the Hornet, looking at me. And I figured, I'm either going to get shot down or thrown in jail. Fortunately, that all worked out because the military individual running the tower at Andrews heard me calling for the controller. The controller didn't answer. And he just invited me to call him on his number when I landed. And he told me he hates that guy. He's a real jerk. He doesn't like clearing planes through airspace. And next time I'm taking off from that little airport, give him a call and he'll clear me through. That's story number one.
It's a good one.
I asked him if... I said, what's the F-18 doing there? He goes, he just wanted to check out your plane. And my thought was, I wonder if he could pay for new seats after I took a look at that thing. Story number two also involves flying. Took off from Atlantic City Airport on a very, very low and cloudy day. Made that flight a number of times and about halfway to Washington. I got a call from Potomac Approach, who told me they just received a call from the airport I took off in, informing me that one of my main landing gear, I had three, I had dropped off and was sitting on the runway back in Atlantic City. I wanted to know what my intentions were. Oh, my first response was, I guess not to crash and die would be at the top of the list. Decided I would turn around and head back. I got to, again, fly over Andrews Air Force Base, and I asked them to take a look at my airplane as I went by, and the tower told me they could only see two landing gear, and the third landing gear had failed to extend. It was unusual for me because I was flying an airplane that had three fixed landing gear. Figured this is not good. I flew back to Atlantic City, where I'm from. Figured I'm going to crash and hopefully survive. At least I'll be close to home in the hospital. I get there. I got to buzz that tower, and they called me and said, I don't know what, who told you what, but looks like he got three good landing gear. Come on in. They closed the airport. Emergency vehicles were there. Probably the worst landing of my life. I landed. They basically said, what are your intentions? And my first response at 10 in the morning was a large glass of alcohol. That was story number two. It turned out that the nose wheel belonged to a different airplane who took off and landed somewhere in Virginia probably rolled out with a much shorter landing roll. Third story. Used to do a lot of fishing living on the coast of southern New Jersey, and was out with one of my closest friends and his father, who owned a really nice sport fishing boat. And we hooked into something very, very large, I guess about 30 or 40 miles offshore. And I fought this thing for, I would say, 2 hours. Every time it got near the boat, it would just tail off and go away. We had no idea what it was. The closest we could think was it was a very, very large tuna, which had been known to populate where it fished. After 2 hours, we finally got a good sighting on it. We could start to see the flash under the water. We were just about to go for it, and the thing was so big, it actually bent and extended the hook, flipped off, and took off. I fell backwards in the boat, hit my head, didn't care, and just cracked up hysterically laughing. So those are the three stories.
Gary, these are really good stories. These are really good stories. Oh my goodness. Holy cow. I'm going to guess the first one is the lie.
First one was absolutely true.
Okay. All
And
right.
I actually got backed up when the controller finally asked me if I was on the frequency. I said, "I've called you 5 times." He said, "I didn't hear you once. Get ready to copy a number." Which, when they tell you to copy a number as a pilot, it's bad, which means the FAA is going to get involved, and you got all sorts of things you have to do. And I said, "Approach." I called 5 times. He goes, "Well, I didn't hear one of them." And the next thing I heard was, "Potomac approach, this is United 247. We heard that guy call 5 times." Then Delta comes on. He goes, "Delta 252. We heard him also." It's like all these other commercial pilots were backing me up. So that turned out okay, fortunately.
Oh,
That one worked out okay.
thank
And
goodness.
I got to know the guys at Andrews because I was flying around there a lot. Highly restricted airspace. And you had to have codes and the rest calls and all the rest of it. It was just a mess. So yeah, that one was true. All right, which of the other two? You want to take another shot, George?
Well, sure. I mean, I'll just say that the second one wasn't true then.
Yeah, second one was also true. It actually got published in Flying Magazine. Got published in Flying Magazine under I learned about flying from that. I'm actually looking at the article, which my wife had cut out and mounted for me, which was kind of cool. Apropos of nothing, I wrote it, and a fellow pilot at the time was also one of the lead writers for the Atlantic Magazine, which has been in the news lately. He and I were in the same, we flew the same airplane. And I wrote it to him and I said, "I'm thinking of submitting this for publication. Can you read it over and give me a few edits?" It came back and looked like it had been attacked in a horror movie. He goes, "Great story, great in the telling. Here's a few suggestions." There was red everywhere. Had I submitted that in English class, it probably would have been D. But it ended up getting published some years ago. And it's one of my better flying stories. So yeah, the fishing story was not true.
Well, there you go.
The tuna never bent the hook. It went into a cave and snapped my line. So
Excellent
those were the three.
misdirection. Excellent. Excellent. Wow. I mean, to be flying what I assume to be a sort of a smaller airplane and then have an F-18 right next to you, I understand why you maybe need to change the upholstery on the
Yeah,
on the seat. Holy cow.
that was quite a day. I was flying a relatively new model airplane at the time, an all glass cockpit called a Cirrus. And it's one of the planes that actually had what's called a ballistic recovery system. It had a parachute that would deploy out the top of the airplane through the skin if you ran out of altitude and ideas and you just couldn't get the plane on the ground. And it saved, the thing has saved dozens of people that have run into problems in flying that. It was pretty new at the time, and the pilot just wanted to take a look at the plane. So that was what he was doing there.
How funny. Excellent. Well, well done. Well, Gary, what is top of mind for you right now?
So Maybe a discussion about trends that are occurring in financial services and financial advisory in general. Some I think are very positive for the industry, but potentially there are some things ahead that could really prove to be challenging, both for the industry and for investors. I had been focusing for quite some time on, in the industry, what is known as a vertical team. A vertical team would be a senior advisor who's been around, let's say 20 years or more, who is at some point looking to pass their business on to a next generation advisor. Over time, as an advisor, George, as you well know, you become very close to your clients. It's unlike any other job that's out there. As an advisor, you have choice as to who you're going to work with, how that relationship will proceed. And from the public's perspective, sometimes it's, well, we're salespeople and, we're going to try and sell you on stuff. And when I started, that was indeed true. I got paid on transactions. I learned early on that the value wasn't in the transaction, the value was in the relationship and the guidance that you could provide if you did the job the right way. I was one of the earlier advisors at Merrill Lynch to transition my business to what I call an outcomes-based approach or a planning-based approach for a fee. I didn't feel that getting paid on a transaction was reasonable or rational. I thought there was an inherent conflict, and every time you'd call someone up and they'd see it was you, they'd tense up. Oh no, I got to make a decision. Is this the right trade, or is this guy just having a bad month? So moving to a fee-based business, I think I was somewhat ahead of the game in doing that. So that's transitioned where now the majority of advisors do fee-based business instead of brokerage, which is just buying and selling financial instruments. Over time, massive businesses were built. It's not unusual for an advisor with 25 or 30 years of tenure to be running half a billion or $1 billion and making a substantial income as a result. But those advisors never forget what it was like to start. Where you start, you get a desk, you get a phone, maybe access to a machine, and a period of time when you have to make it. Most people fail. It's a hard job. But if you're cut out for it, it is the greatest job in the world because you get to make a real difference for people. And you understand that most of the people that you're dealing with, regardless of the fact they're successful in their own world, they come into the world of financial instruments and they're terrified. They try and educate themselves, but it's hard to do. Yes, can you do it full time? Yeah, you probably can. But then something else plays in, and that's the discipline to maintain your approach. And unfortunately, we have these machines in front of us we stare at every day with our phones and the computer with algorithms designed to keep our eyeballs on what the algorithm thinks we're going to look at. And most of them involve showing you news or information that you already know. It just affirms your position because they want your eyeballs to stay there a little longer. So fear plays a large part in what goes on. There's biases that come in. There's a confirmation bias. You're always going to look for people that agree with you. There's recency bias. Whatever I've been doing the last time, it should work this time. And there's fear that's driven about realizing perhaps you've made a mistake. Professional advisor, a good one, is going to recognize A, what those mistakes will be if they're made when that investor comes to them, and B, how to make certain that a discipline is consistently applied over whatever period of time is in question. And education and counseling is where you spend most of your time. I spend as much time with my clients convincing them of things they shouldn't do as opposed to things they should. When markets become untethered, a period when right now and logic seems to flee, this is when an advisor really earns their money because most people left to their own devices are going to make mistakes. So there is a whole core of senior advisors out there. And the problem that I see is probably 35 to 40% of those advisors, true experience and the ability to really guide successful people, are going to be retiring over the next 5 to 7 years. The problem is this: those advisors being senior control a disproportionate amount of assets that are under management at the large wealth management firms right across the board, whether it's a registered investment advisory firm that is regulated by the SEC or a broker dealer, which is my world, which is regulated by FINRA. And their clients are aging as well. So what McKinsey found, that I completely agree with them, is there's almost $15 trillion that's going to be coming and looking for a home. And most large broker dealer firms, and the RIAs are doing this as well, they're seeking to keep the advisors at the company that they currently work at through their retirement. And they do that by offering them fairly substantial buyouts on their business. This was never done in the past. But they'll pay them some multiple of what their business is in the hopes that the advisor will pass that business on to a younger or next generation financial advisor. That can be one of their kids, by way of example, or it could be another advisor that they've decided to partner with that they're basically trying to mentor. And the way that mentoring is occurring is, to my way of thinking, completely ineffective. I had no plan B when I started. I was 24 years old. I knew this was the job I wanted. My first year, I made a lot of mistakes. I made a lot of mistakes my second and third year. I made mistakes throughout my career. But reflecting on those mistakes allowed me not to make them more than once, maybe twice occasionally. But that's where you learn. So the experience you get with skinning your knuckles and falling down and getting yourself back up, as long as you get up more than you fall, you can make it in the job because you realize there's something larger out there. You can make a difference for people. This generation doesn't have that. The next generation of FAs that are coming in to succeed are, yeah, they're sophisticated in technology. They can write, get financial plans done. They act as almost an aide, a well-paid aide to the advisor they're working for. But the advisors are very protective of their relationships. And for the most part, they're not doing a great job with their current clients who are around their age category in introducing their current clients, A, to the next advisor, and B, seeking to go and have their own heirs meet with that younger advisor. And the younger advisor, since they're being very well paid, don't feel the urge to learn. They get comfortable, complacent, and you could have an advisor in their mid to late 20s earning $150,000, where had they started as I started, and probably likely as you started, where the best they could have done for that tenure in the business is maybe they're making half that. So there's no urge to go out and learn how to create relationships based on empathy and trust early on. There's a real hesitancy to expose themselves because of the mistakes they're afraid they're going to make. And they just kind of hang around and wait for the senior advisor to give them more of their own book equity, more of a sharing thing, and try and find ways to be useful. And invariably, what happens when that advisor retires is roughly 50% of that advisor's book will seek help elsewhere. They will not go to the younger advisor. They've not developed a relationship. And that advisor is going to see that business basically fall apart. Maybe they don't care. I don't know. But I do know the impact on the public is dramatic. 90% of an investor's heirs, their kids, are going to go someplace else entirely because there's no relationship with that next advisor as well. And it's kind of the worst kept secret in the industry right now. Every firm out there is trying to figure out how to deal with it. Some firms are doing better than others. I spend an extraordinary amount of time working with very senior advisors, many of whom I actually trained some years ago when I was at Merrill. And I work with them to restructure their compensation schemes to have the younger advisor much more reliant on what they can do on their own. It's better for the public that you've got an advisor's experience in that way. It's better for the senior advisor because they have more comfort in moving their book. And for the junior advisor, if that's something they don't want to do, then perhaps the role of financial advisor doesn't really fit what they're going to do. To me, that was a title you had to earn every day. And unfortunately, the way things are occurring now, it worries me. So it fuels my consulting practice. It fuels my speaking engagements. And when I work with these junior and senior teams, the senior guys get it immediately. And I get to say things to their junior partners they can't say. And one of the things I always think about, and then I'll pause here, is as with my clients, I will always tell someone what they need to hear. It may not necessarily match with what they want to hear. If it does, that's great. If it doesn't, I'm really sorry, but this is how I see it. And I think I've been around long enough to call those balls and strikes in a fairly agnostic way. So I will pause there.
Well, that certainly makes a lot of sense. And $15 trillion is an awful lot. And I don't know if there's too many senior advisors out there who just are happy walking away and then watching what they built fall apart. So I'm sure that people are motivated to try to do a good job for some people probably have legacy concerns, but just want to make sure that the people that they've worked with for so many years continue to get taken care of in a way that they know. That they've provided. So why not try and be proactive about this? And I certainly know how difficult it is to find the right people to come into the business. And it sounds like there may be some people who found their way in that maybe ought not or won't fit the model that you're talking about. And so this is a new opportunity to sort of rescreen them. Say, hey, would you be amenable to having a conversation about changing your compensation plan with greater upside in the future, but maybe having to take a step back.
That's exactly correct. And what I do is, since as a financial advisor, basically your word is your bond. If you tell somebody something that's going to happen, you can't go back on it. So I don't anticipate, and my guidance is never to alter that younger advisor's compensation in the first year. I do it by restructuring how that advisor's book lays out. For most senior advisors, they've got about 20% of their household or clients that they serve generating a disproportionate amount of income, 75 or 80% of the income. You can call it the Pareto effect or 80-20 or whatever you want to call it. One of the first questions I ask is, if you have 200 households and we've got these 40 households paying 80% of your time, are you devoting 80% of your income? Are you devoting 80% of your time to those households? And that kind of gets one of these and like that and all the rest of it. And the answer is always no. They don't. As advisors get better, they get larger and larger accounts, and they become disproportionately more financially meaningful to that advisor. But the advisor doesn't really see it as far as compensating on the other way by giving time back. So I try and kind of cordon that book off. And then I look at the lower productive accounts, which maybe have gone through inheritance, job change, a variety of things. But that's the group of accounts the advisor is usually not talking to very frequently. And that's the group that I want the junior advisor to really work with, reprofile, to rerun a financial plan, to find out where the other assets are, build up the skill set and the muscle memory on a smaller revenue portion of the book, but a larger volume of the book gives the advisor a much greater upside potential. And also allows them to kind of do that training on the job. The senior advisor always behind them. The goal that a lot of the firms have is, well, the senior advisor is going to mentor the younger advisor. And I would tell you that that doesn't happen. Because, and I'll equate it to what I mentioned earlier, that my part-time work as a ski instructor in Vail, Colorado. I deal with a lot of the same emotions with my guests that I used to deal with investors. Investors that I have are successful in whatever they do. They come to a financial advisor and they hope that that person is the right person, but they don't know. It takes a long time. So you're dealing with that fear and that apprehension. As a ski instructor, it's the same thing. People are very successful to come here. They come out on the mountain the first time that they've tried whatever it is they're going to try. And they're hopeful that they can learn what to do. And it's not a physical limitation they deal with. It's a mental limitation. It's fear, your brain trying to get you back to things that you think are going to work, and even though they don't. When I first started teaching at Vail 6 years ago, when I arrived here, I was a very strong skier. I always was. I didn't know the first thing about teaching skiing, not a clue. And I've been studying it ever since. It took me a year to get my first level certification and then 2.5 years to get my second. And it gets harder as you go up. And it's not about being a good skier. It's about learning how to convey that information to someone in a way where you meet them where they are. The senior financial advisor, most advisors are very good at managing their clients. They don't know the first thing about teaching someone to be a great advisor. In the same way, I was a very strong skier, didn't know how to teach. I was very lucky because at Merrill, I stumbled into a process which I was asked to see if I could train. And me and one other fellow spent almost 12 years and trained over 10,000 advisors. And every program we learned how to do it better. So it's a problem out there. And that solution is not ideal that we're seeing right now. From the public's perspective, the public's listening, there are certain things that you should look for when you're dealing with an advisor. Identifying an outcome and being able to look at each investment you have and tie it directly to outcomes that are most important to you. I don't care if it's tomorrow, next week, 10 years, or 30 years down the line. At that point, it just becomes mathematics. You make conservative assumptions. If you're investing trying to beat the market, you're already making a mistake. First question is, why are you trying to do that? Second question is, what return do you actually need to satisfy your goals? And the third question is, can you tie every investment you're making to your underlying goals? If you're an investor, look at your statements and ask yourself if every investment in your portfolio, wherever it might be, ties to something specific in your life that you want as a goal. And again, it's just math. If your advisor hasn't done that with you, you need a new advisor. Can you do it on your own? Yeah, you probably can. But you're going to need to focus on it and overcome the emotional limitations that fear is going to place on you, especially in periods such as this. The second thing is this. How do you know if you have a good advisor? It's the only time you hear from them to discuss what's going on financially with you. You probably need to get somebody that's got more time that they can spend with you. The majority of my calls that I would make, outbound calls, were just to let my people know I was thinking about. You're in their life and you're there hopefully for a very long time. And I would make regular calls to the clients and talk to them about what's going on. How's work? How's life? How are the kids? Everything's fine on this side. Just hadn't talked to you in a month or so. Just wanted to catch up. As a result of that, my business grew through introductions and referrals. I never really lost a client. Occasionally, I'd move a client to someone else, but I always kept my book, my household, small enough that I could be in contact with people. Because the key to being a really good advisor is, you know, obviously you've got to have trust. Your word is your bond, but you've got to really care about the people that have trusted you coming the other way, and they become your friends. And there's just no other way to look at it. If you don't have a relationship with your advisor, find one that you can develop that with. Ask them how frequently they're going to hear from you, and will it only be to discuss money? So just a couple of things to think about.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. For those senior advisors out there who are listening, say, oh, Gary's talking about me. What do they do? What questions should they be asking to know if now is the time to be having these kinds of conversations?
If they're within 10 years of transition, they're in that zone where every day that they wait to have a firm plan or something where they can be thinking about training their next gen advisor, every day they wait, they're taking their business further in the red. There are things that can happen unexpectedly. A senior advisor can have an illness upon them. As we get older, that becomes more likely. But you want to get to the point where you're entering that kind of, let's call it that end phase of your career. Your stress level should be going down, not up, which means that you should have someone that you trust, that you like, that is being mentored properly, that needs to look at that junior advisor and ask themselves a question. If that advisor were left to their own devices, just and I wasn't here, and they started from scratch, would they have been able to build a business that ultimately looks like the business I have today? If that answer is no, you have a gap in training. You have a gap in motivation. You have a gap in intent. And that's where I get involved. And I'm very supportive of both, but I spend a lot of time with both individuals or multiple individuals on a team, really making certain that that next generation advisor understands what they're getting into. And the mentoring that I do, the training that I do, comes with accountability. And I find that as I hold these team members, these younger team members accountable, they're either going to respond or they're not. And if we go through a period of 6 months to a year and I'm not seeing it, I will go to that senior advisor and I say, look, there's some issues here that we just can't seem to overcome. We're doing a little bit better, but here's where we're at. Let's talk about possibly bringing in some other potential candidates to pick things up as we go. And it might be me introducing that senior advisor to another team with senior advisors that has the personnel and do it. Or it might be just interviewing potential new hires. My goal is for that senior advisor to have a great exit. So there's an assessment and analysis that I do in front of every single one. Every senior advisor I work with understands the issue. Frankly, George, I would tell you that most of them are quiet to be terrified. You mentioned something, I'll repeat. The worst case scenario is the senior advisor retires, and then a year later, they run into a very good friend who was one of their larger clients. And sheepishly, that client says, hey, George, I'm really sorry, but I'm not sure if you knew, but I moved my accounts over from, company X to company Y. I just didn't feel I was getting the same level of care and service that you provided. And I really appreciate everything you did, but I just couldn't leave the money there. If you're the advisor and your advisor, it's the worst thing that can happen because you failed that client. Even though they're no longer a client, doesn't matter. You failed your friend because you didn't prepare properly. I was actually the beneficiary of that in several cases where I would go in to refer to a client and I reviewed everything and the client would look great. Everything looked great on paper. And I won the account because in one case, I remember it specifically, the investor basically said after I told him he should stay where he is, he said, get out your transfer papers, I'm coming with you. And he finally told me, my best friend and best man has been my advisor for 35 years. He's retiring, leaving the business to his son. And the son's a schmuck. I'll never forget it. And I don't like him. So you win.
Compelling reasons.
So there you go. Had nothing to do with investment returns. It had to do with the relationship that they had. So the public needs to be aware of it. They can access McKinsey's report if they want to, but they need to know what that next generation looks like. And it's not going to look like what they had unless they're really letting that advisor, that senior advisor, is letting that advisor go out there and figure it out for themselves with some guidance around the edges.
Makes sense. Well, Gary, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people learn more about you and how can they engage with you?
So a couple of ways. On my website, which is called Better Path Training. Better Path is all one word, betterpathtraining.com. There's a number of resources up there for professionals that they can go up and access. There's information about how they can get in touch with me to discuss possibly me doing an initial assessment of what's happening in their practice and going from there. There's also a podcast I'm going to be debuting over the next, I would say, probably 2 to 3 weeks. And the title of the podcast, with a wink and a nod, is If the Public Only Knew. And what it does is it's guidance for both advisors and the investing public. If you're an investor, what you should know about financial advisory. More and more people are coming to professional advisors as their assets expand. They're also more willing to pay for advice, which is a great trend. By the same token, there's advisors out there that need to understand from the public's perspective what they're looking for. So both perspectives are going to be featured on that podcast. It'll be announced on that website and probably announced on my LinkedIn, where they can also follow and find me just by inputting my name, Gary Cinderbrand. They can see information there as well. So hopefully we'll see some folks show up, but the website's going to be the best way to access it, betterpathtraining.com.
Excellent. Well, if you enjoyed as much as I did, show Gary your appreciation. Share today's show with a friend who also appreciates good ideas, or your favorite financial advisor. Go to betterpathtraining.com and check out the great resources. Check out the If the Public Only Knew podcast. And certainly if you're within 10 years of retirement as a financial advisor, it is a benefit to you to be considering the things that Gary's been talking about today. So thanks again, Gary.
Pleasure, George. Thanks so much.
Finally, friendly reminder, there's never going to be anybody more interested in your financial success than you are. So act accordingly.